You can interact with us so many ways. Go to www.emsgarage.com. Email us, emsgarage@gmail.com. Go to our Twitter account, @emsgarage. Or you can download us on iTunes. Just search EMS Garage. You can also call us, 303-720-6001. The EMS Garage.
Okay, I got DC on the phone there wanting to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Paramedic 22 is on scene.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the EMS Garage. It's your weekly EMS podcast about all things that concern you with EMS, and we do current events and all kinds of fun things. You know, you can find us on iTunes. You can find us right from the website, EMS Garage. You can send us an email, emsgarage@gmail.com. Become our fan on Facebook, Twitter, whatever you want to do. We're everywhere, but we'd love to have you on. So this week, we're going to talk about H1N1, the swine flu, again, because apparently it's becoming big again or something. But this time I actually have people that know what they're talking about on the podcast. So that'll be a good thing instead of listening to me banter. I'm your host, Chris Montero, and thanks for joining us. Joining me tonight from the land of Canada, Rob Terrio from Ontario. Hello, sir.
Hi, Chris, everyone. Hi, everyone. Sorry, I should say. I'm trying out this new tongue. I'm just getting used to it. Great to be here. This is an interesting discussion. I'm always, on this particular topic, I'm cautious about being a doomsayer and cautious about being cavalier about it, too. So it's always good for discussion.
Right. And I feel the same way, too. I feel like, are we just overblowing this? Is this another way, you know, for the CDC to make money, whatever? But I don't know. Somebody's making money on it, but it's not me. So, but thanks for joining us. Are you guys back in class then now or no? Rob? Hello? I guess I lost Rob. I don't know where he went. We'll bring him back in a minute. Jamie Davis, the pod medic. How are you, sir?
I am doing very well. How are you?
I'm good. What are you up to these days?
Oh, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, podcasting, and I'm so happy my kids are back in school, and I get my days back to get stuff done.
I know. My kids and my wife started school this week, too, and I'm just like, oh, every Friday's mine again. Oh, I'm so excited. I love having them home, but at the same time, it's nice to have a little bit of me time, so that'll be good. It's my day to create, which is good. So I'm glad the kids are in school for you.
Me too.
Hey, Rob, are you guys back in class now?
We start on September the 8th, so I'm back at college. I've been back for a week and a half just preparing for the onslaught.
Gotcha. Here it comes. Yeah. Mr. I've already done Jamie Davis. Gosh, I don't even know where I'm at. I'm reading down the list. Mr. Greg Fries from EPS 411 and all their great sites. Hello, sir.
Hi, Chris and everybody else. Great to be here.
Thanks for coming on. I know you're only on for a short time, so when you need to jump off. But
okay.
Continue in. So what are you up to these days? Anything good? I saw you're trying to ride to Lambeau Field. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. On Sunday, I'm planning a cross-state bike ride from where I live in central Wisconsin to Lambeau Field.
Nice. Are the Packers playing?
I don't think so.
Oh.
No. It's just a destination.
Oh, okay.
And my hometown, so I'll see some friends and family once I'm there.
Very cool. How many miles is that?
You know, I haven't figured out my route yet. I'm hoping it's around 100.
Holy doodle.
Can I ask why?
With the wind downhill.
Oh, okay.
Well, it was one of my summer goals was to do that, and I sort of feel like Labor Day here in the States is the last day of summer, so I better get it done on Sunday.
Oh, very cool. Well, I was thinking about doing a bike ride this weekend myself. But nothing quite the same, but only about 30 miles. So
Mile High Stadium.
Yeah,
exactly. I'd have to map out the PCI centers along the route.
That's good. Oh my goodness. Oh well, thanks guys for joining us. Also joining us tonight from the State Fair near a screaming ride is Gary Wingrove. Hello. He's probably muted, so it's going to take him a minute to... Ah, there he is.
Hey,
hello.
I'm here. Hey.
You're at the Minnesota State Fair.
I am, yep, and I had to listen to the radio there, so I kept you muted for a bit.
Oh, that's
sorry
good.
About that.
No problem, no problem. Well, just we're glad you're here, and we're talking about H1N1 tonight, you know that. Anything you want to update us on in your life, or anything fun, anything good going on?
No, it's all fair all the time through Labor Day here, so that's about it.
I know, we really missed you last week in Park City, so we'll get to see you soon. That'll be good. So joining us tonight to talk about our H1N1 podcast are two industry experts, and I'm just going to say that now. Mr. Vincent, doctor, are you a doctor, Vincent?
Yes, sir.
Dr. Vincent Rancheliello. Okay, you're going to have to say it for me.
Rancheliello.
Oh, I want to say the C.
It's a hard C.
Yeah, it is. So, Doc, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a professor at Columbia, which is a university here in New York City, and I work on viruses. I have a lab. We do research on a variety of viruses. I teach students how to research them and be scientists, and I teach some classes, too.
And don't you also have a podcast?
I have a podcast called This Week in Virology, which we started just about a year ago. And I also blog a couple times a week. I've been doing that for about 5 years, all about viruses. And it's virology.ws.
Wow. I didn't realize there were so many things to talk about viruses.
I could talk even more than I do. These are things that I do outside of my job. So my job is not to podcast and blog, right? But I do it because I found that so many people really enjoy learning about viruses for somebody who works on them with their hands every day. And so I get enormous feedback and great questions, so I keep doing it, even though I might lose my job one day because of it.
Never.
I think we're all in the same boat there.
Yeah, you know, it's really addictive, and the audience is what drives it, as you guys all know, right?
Absolutely.
You resisted the temptation to say it's infectious, but I'm quite impressed.
Yeah, it's a good one. I used addiction, which probably isn't part of virology, but...
I think it'd be best if we washed our hands of puns like that.
Oh.
Well,
hey, don't get all worked up into a lather.
Kind of, how are you going to wash your hands? Do you have a sanitizer or soap and water?
When I don't have organic debris, I'm content to use a sanitizer.
Great.
And Chris, now that I know what he does, I think I'm going to pack up and go over to the swine barn and connect in from there.
Oh, nice. That's perfect. Just don't kiss any pigs, Gary. Well, joining us, also speaking about public health, because that's really what this is about, is Miss Ann Robinson. She's a public health nurse here in my community. Know her very well, and I basically goaded her on to get on this podcast. She's like, I don't know, should I really join? So, hi, Ann Robinson, how are you?
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
About myself, here in Eagle County, Colorado, and loving working in public health, nursing background, but in public health for a little over 2 years, and been way thrown into this H1N1 thing and living up to it and involved with it every moment of every day. So, and on the side, I kind of work a little bit with EMS, with WECAD, with Chris and his crew, and throughout the county and on some really up-and-coming projects. So this is kind of exciting.
Well, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it. So I guess tonight really what I wanted to do is kick this puppy off is to ask Vincent, is H1N1 overblown? Is it really going to be as bad as we say? Is it going to mutate? Are people going to die? Is it going to be just as bad as the seasonal flu? Or are we just all getting worked up in a lather, sorry, for nothing? And just go ahead and tell us what you know.
Well, certainly it's being way overblown, but that's what the press does for a living, right? They make their money by making headlines, and so all the journalists do that. So every day it's been in the news. Every time someone dies, there's a story about it. And, you know, many other diseases kill a lot more people, and we don't talk about them. For some reason, flu takes everybody's interest. So it's overblown, but yeah, it's going to kill people because, you know, seasonal flu kills 30,000 people a year in the U.S. And that's when we have some immunity to the virus. And here's a brand new one, which no one has immunity to, or only those over 65, apparently. So it's going to infect a lot of people. So maybe more people than 30,000 will die. But the whole idea, this really bugs me, this whole idea of it mutating, which is all based on the 1918 influenza, where, you know, it came in two or three waves and seemed to get more serious each time. And many people like to say that's because the virus mutated, but in fact, we don't even know if it did. We don't even know if it was the same virus or not. So, you know, every newspaper has grabbed hold of this mutating wave idea, but there's zero evidence for it. So I don't think it's going to get any worse. I think it's just going to keep spreading until more people are immune and it reverts to a seasonal type of infection.
Well, let me ask you, do you think, because I've read extensively about the 1918 Spanish flu, and do you think that we've, maybe perhaps the reason so many people died then is because we didn't have a good grasp on healthcare and not spreading disease and just taking care of people in general and taking care of dehydration and all of those issues, that maybe we wouldn't have the same type of death that we had in that flu?
Well, that's a good question. You know, that from the, we have one virus from 1918 that was reconstructed in the laboratory. And so we didn't have virology back then. We didn't even know it was influenza virus, but just a few years ago, some virologists were able to reconstruct the virus. And we know that that virus is really lethal compared to other strains of influenza. So there's no doubt that there's something special about that virus that was in 1918. But I think you're right. I think the healthcare infrastructure, you know, the antibiotic situation, the fact that there was a war going on, which was moving troops all over the place, I think those were major contributors to the lethality. And I would really be surprised if today, with everything we have, that even if that virus would be as lethal.
Very good point. So what do we want to do as responders in the instance that it becomes, I don't know, would it ever get to pandemic portions or epidemic portions?
I think you're going to see lots of infections. And as you know, there are people that respond very badly to influenza. You know, I'm sure all of you have taken care of them. And you're going to see the same thing, but maybe in slightly higher numbers. So you do it, you take care of it in the same way. You just have to be aware that this season, maybe the numbers are going to be higher. So otherwise, it's the same, I would suspect. I mean, I think you guys should comment because you respond to, you know, people with respiratory distress as a result of an infection.
I have a question real quick, if I can jump in, Chris.
Yeah, go ahead, absolutely.
Because this is something that comes up all the time. We talk about pandemic, we talk about epidemic. These are two words that are thrown around often interchangeably, and yet they both have very different meanings.
Right.
I'm not sure if Ann or Vince would like to jump in with an explanation of what the two of them mean, but I think that's something we need to really make sure everybody understands.
Okay, so that's a good point, and many people don't. So an epidemic is simply an outbreak of a disease. And if you have an outbreak of influenza in New Jersey, it's an epidemic. Or in several states in the U.S., it's an epidemic. When it spreads globally to two or three or more countries, then we call it either a worldwide epidemic or a pandemic. So in those words, only refer to the spread of the infection. They have no implications for the severity of the infection at all. And so I think many people hear pandemic and they immediately think of massive dying, but it's not part of that word at all. It just refers to the amount of spread of the infection.
I think that's an important distinction because I think you're right. People automatically go, oh, it's a pandemic. A lot of people are going to die.
Well, in fact, the WHO a few months ago was thinking of redefining pandemic because people, at the beginning of this outbreak, people were freaking out. And they said, well, you know, it's not so serious. Maybe we should redefine pandemic, in which case that's silly because, you know, there were a pandemic. It's been called pandemics for ages, even before there was a WHO. So That's not Vincent, a solution.
Vincent, a lot of countries are not required to report it, and in many cases not even testing for H1N1. So we know there's probably a significant underestimation of the spread of the virus. So what would be the criteria then for requiring countries to begin to report it?
Well, WHO some time ago decided that it wasn't worth the effort to be testing every suspected case. And so now, you know, fever, cough, sore throat is what CDC says is suspected influenza. And so then you guys...
Sorry, I was going to say, what about the reporting piece, though? What, once you, like, patients come in and they are quite sick and they've got a cough and a fever, what about the reporting component?
It's a tough one, because if you report it as influenza, you may over-report it, right? But I suspect that that's what happens in the end. If someone comes in with those symptoms in the absence of a diagnostic test, they just write it as influenza. Especially in a pandemic year like this, where you're probably going to be right most of the time, not all of the time, but most of the time, whereas as opposed to a seasonal influenza year where there are probably a lot of other viruses mixed in there causing the same symptoms.
Did you want to say something, Ann?
I did. Well, here in our little Eagle County, we're not into collecting how many cases we can diagnose as H1N1 or seasonal influenza. I mean, we're really down to, let's just contain the illness, let's just keep people at home, keep them healthy, and, you know, we're just not tracking each and every one of the, we're not even encouraging physicians to test for H1N1. At this point, we're only testing those who are hospitalized or healthcare providers. So it's not putting another mark in our belt to say, oh, we have another one, and that's, you know, not where we're going with this, nor is it our focus.
Yeah, but it seemed early on that that seemed to be the thing to do. It was in vogue to, oh, gee, we have an H1N1 case now, and that was exciting. And now it's like, yeah, it's just the season. It's a flu. Okay.
Well, I think we had to know that early on to get an understanding of how extensively the virus was spreading and where. You know, but once it was established that it was a pandemic strain, then you're right. You don't have to do that anymore. The main question is, how do you take care of your patients, right? If it's a young and healthy person that's not at risk, you know, as Zan said, you isolate them and let the disease run its course. But if they have risk factors like pregnancy or immunosuppression, then you have to do something else.
One of the questions we were trying to grapple with at the community college where I teach is, how do we decide when to close down the school? Public health has asked us to try to track the number of students reporting sick or not attending due to illness, and this is not something we've ever really done before. And of course, as you know, at university or college, you know, if they attend, great. If they don't, they don't. So any suggestions about how, you know, a school might sort of begin to track that to help public health in that aspect?
Well, I can answer to that and what we're doing here. And it's really working with your school and reporting similar type illnesses. You know, if you have one classroom that has 10 people, students out with the same type of illness, you have one school with multiple students reporting that, or is it just hit and miss? I mean, we have seasonal influenza. We've had that every year. This year, no, we don't quite have that vaccine up and going with H1N1, so we're going to see more occurrences of it. But again, it's that clustering that we're concerned about. And, you know, sometimes it's not always the right choice to shut down a school, but more work with the school and reporting that clustering in a classroom or a whole school of what's going on with similar illnesses.
No, I feel that given the relative the lack of severity of this particular strain, I think it panics people if you close schools. Mm. And the problem is that if you have one kid in a school who's infected, it's likely that that child can spread it to everyone relatively rapidly. So I'm not sure that closing the school will really help all that much. So, you know, if you do that, you make people afraid. So I'm not sure which is worse, given them pretty mild influenza in terms of mortality.
Well, and I agree. We don't want to shut schools down, but I also don't want half the school to be up sick with a similar illness. And it's whether it's seasonal influenza, H1N1, or something else, I think we need to treat it all the same. And it, if anything, this has heightened the awareness of, you know, infectious disease that is out there and amongst our community. And how do we react to it? And, you know, this is a mild illness, but maybe this is just getting us prepared for when that severe illness comes through.
So do you close schools for seasonal flu when you have a certain number of kids who are sick?
You know, we haven't had that yet. And so, no, we wouldn't. I would, and in the history of Eagle County School District, we haven't closed schools for any illnesses up until this point. But that's part of us working and planning and that interaction with the schools ahead of time so that they can help monitor those things that are going on. So the school nurses are saying, wow, the STEM teacher, half her class is out, and this town, half of the students are out. That's when we're more concerned. But it's not only just H1N1, but it's infectious disease in general.
So let me ask, how would you recommend that we stay safe from disease? You know, if we're, should we all be walking around with N95 masks and in gloves and gowns and spit shields and everything, or
what, spit shields?
I couldn't think of the term. Safety glasses, whatever. Should we be doing that, or I mean, what should we be doing? You know, I said early on in this disease that when I see the county epidemiologist walking around with all of that stuff on, I'll be afraid. But until then, I'm not really afraid. So I don't know if I'm just being crazy there, or how do you guys feel about that?
Well, maybe we should just mention how it's spread, because, you know, it is spread by aerosols, which are made by coughing, sneezing, or just talking. You know, talking generates an amazing amount of aerosol. So if you're in a room with someone who's got influenza and they're talking, you could be easily infected. So, you know, there's not much you can do about that aside from wearing a respirator. But then it can also be spread on hands and surfaces. You know, the virus has been shown in daycare centers to last on toys for several days. So, you know, I think you have to practice good hygiene. You have to wash your hands. And you know, if you go into a public area and you touch things, you should wash before you touch your face or your eyes. But in terms of the aerosol, I think there's not a lot you can do.
Well,
now, would it be overreacting to have...
I would say prevention is number one.
Prevent, and how do you how do we prevent it, though? Anne? Hello? Anne, how do we prevent it? Okay, maybe we don't. I don't know. Maybe the public health nurse has nothing to say about prevention, which is kind of funny.
Oh, sorry. It's breaking in and out. Oh,
no problem.
Prevention. I mean, get your flu shots. Get your seasonal flu shots. Get your H1N1 flu shots, which you're in those target, you know, categories and, you know, the high-risk groups. But that's how you prevent it. And wash your hands if you're home. If you're sick, stay home. You know, don't go and spread the illness. And I think that can make a bigger impact and a bigger difference than anything else.
So this is a show for EMS providers. So what are some of the recommendations we should do, A, as EMS leaders, and B, as EMS providers, to ensure that our staff is safe and that, you know, the people we're taking care of aren't infecting our entire staff?
Well, I'll put in my little two cents of a public health nurse here on an EMS show and to find my way through this EMS world. Spending some time on the ambulance and really trying to figure out what's the difference between a public health nurse and a paramedic or an EMT basic. There's a huge difference in what we do and how we do it. And it's become a huge reality to me in trying to spend time and, you know, look at our two healthcare systems and how we can integrate together. But, I mean, that's one note. But aside from that, it's, you know, what can we do to get our N95 mask fit testing done ahead of time? what can we do to make sure everyone's vaccinated accordingly, and working together to make that happen, if it's not even pulling in the paramedics to help us vaccinate these first responders. I mean, they're a key person in the healthcare system to be able to help us with that. And so we haven't been tapping into that, and we need to. And there's not enough nurses, public health nurses, or even healthcare providers in general to be able to take care of prevention of a new illness that's emerged. And so let's really tap into these paramedics and work together to be able to get these first responders vaccinated and get their N95 fit mask test done at the time.
So I have a thing.
Go ahead, Jamie.
I was going to say, you know, something I've been talking about since this first came up in the news is that there really needs to be a push for us to really get on our providers for good hand washing technique. You know, it is, I think, one of the things I see least least stressed for EMS providers in my experience is that hand washing, you know, after every call. It's not always possible to wash your hands before you get to your patients, but you can use sanitizer gels and things like that. But, you know, when you get to the hospital and you're handing off that patient, wash your hands and then, you know, clean up your rig and then wash them again when you get back to the station. Those are things that are some of the simplest prevention techniques that don't require us to add additional stockpiles or buy additional supplies. And it can be a relatively simple solution based upon everything I've read about this particular outbreak and any other seasonal flu. That's just one of the simplest solutions. Am I correct?
I think it goes a long way, absolutely. But remember that you still have an aerosol component, so you have to deal with that as well.
So how aerosolized, Vincent, can you tell me from the experience that we've already had with this disease, that people that get infected with it, how aerosolized is it? Or how virulent, is that right? I can't pronounce words, you know that. But is that more virulent if they in the aerosol, or is it more of a with just a cough? Or I mean, where does that lie?
Well, so virulence and transmissibility are two different things, right? Okay, virulence is—it's okay. Virulence.
I'm not the
just,
virologist here, so
virulence is just how severe the infection is. So the virulence of a virus is how sick it makes you, basically. Okay. And transmissibility is how well it spreads from one person to another. And this virus is spreading pretty readily globally because nobody's immune to it. But it seems to be transmitted by the typical routes of influenza. There are differences in transmissibility, but it's hard to make those comparisons right now. I mean, I would say, you know, talking or coughing or sneezing are all going to spread the virus pretty effectively. Here's an interesting story. You know, in an airplane a few years ago, a study was done with one person sitting in the front sneezing, infected the whole airplane with influenza, 75 passengers, something like that. So if you have air recirculation, which you have, you know, in all big buildings nowadays, a few people coughing and sneezing will effectively spread the infection. Now, we can't spread it to each other because we're isolated electronically, but if we were in the same room, we could spread it. You know, we could wash our hands and do all of that, but in the end, breathing is going to get us. So
and what the word I was trying to search for was droplet protection, because they always say, you know, if you cough, you have droplets, or if you sneeze, it's more droplets. But sure. Which is different than I would assume aerosolized, which was because when I speak, like you said, there's aerosolized droplets in that,
and that's why you need your spit shields.
Yes, right. Spit shields, yes. The name of the podcast. Well, so the N95 masks, is that appropriate, or do you think...
No, those are good. Those have been shown in studies to work well, especially if they're worn properly and properly fitted, as was mentioned. So, you know, if you're going to respond and you suspect, or not even, if you go respond, you should wear one, especially at the height of the flu season. I think that's going to help you a lot.
Okay. And then what about... go ahead, Greg.
Well, I was just going to ask a question about those N95 masks. And differing things. You know, Rob will attest it. In Canada, there's strong feelings that it's a single-use item, and then I'm being told here in Wisconsin that we should reuse them, and even if they're in short supply, we should cover the N95 with a surgical mask, a disposable surgical mask, so then we could use that N95 mask even more before disposing of it. And it just seems to me like there's differing information and misinformation about how effective those are and how they should be used.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of experience with working on those, but I do know that if you breathe in one for a while, you're going to get, if you're infected, you're going to get virus in it. And if you're, you know, breathing contaminated air, it's going to get contaminated. So it makes sense to me to not reuse them.
And do you have a best practice on that, as far as how often they should be used or not?
Well, at this point, they are a one-time use mechanism. And as soon as they're wet or saturated, you need to trade out and get a new one. And they wouldn't recommend putting an N95 mask on and a surgical mask over it, and that's per CDC guidelines.
Okay. I'm going to send Chris the memo from the Wisconsin Department of Public Health about this, the link to that, because it just seems so bizarre and outrageous to me when I received it that it's worth sharing.
Well, we got a similar thing because they were in short supply. I mean, every company had their minimum requirement from the state, inventory that we have to maintain on hand. But we quickly realized, I mean, if we have to wear an N95, if every person who comes in close contact with that patient has to wear an N95 mask on every suspected influenza call, you know, every person with a normal cold, we're going to run, there aren't enough N95 masks to cover all the EMS providers, let alone the hospital staff and everybody else. How are we supposed to deal with that? Because I really don't think the supply is there unless something's happened in the last few months since the initial outbreak.
Well, let me ask you this. In the past, before April, how did you respond with seasonal influenza? What type of mask did you use?
Didn't. We didn't get into using masks with any influenza patients. I mean, we have our flu shots, and it seemed that we didn't need to really worry about it. If they were... If the patient was in some kind of respiratory distress, we would encourage them to use a mask. That seemed to that was one way we were told that could help contain droplet, was to put a non-rebreather on the patient. If they needed oxygen and support there, but we didn't use anything prior to this, and obviously, the rules have not changed, but they've become reinforced, I guess.
Okay, so I would recommend, and I guarantee you, you're on the, you know, those priority tiers to get the H1N1 as soon as it's released. Work with your public health department, get those H1N1 shots, and continue, responding the same way you do with seasonal influenza. It isn't any different. It just might be more cases, so you have to prevent it ahead of time.
Well, but like Jamie was saying, though, we've had an influenza shot in the past, so I guess through dumb luck, we were probably just like, we've already been vaccinated for that, so we don't need that. However, you know, the reports say, you know, the H1N1 has... I always forget the difference between shift and mutate, but... it's been a few years since I've had biology, but so the difference between that and has the virus shifted at all to a different strain or to a more
virulent.
I can never say it. Strain, or is it something that we, you know, I mean, because the vaccine may not be effective, we really don't know. Has it been tested? Do we know how good this vaccine is going to be?
Well, the new vaccine. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, it's fine. You're more the expert on that one.
I'm not sure. The new vaccines that are being produced against the new strain will be as effective against it as the seasonal vaccines are against seasonal strain. It's not perfect, but when you immunize a good percentage of the population, it does pretty well. The problem with this strain is that it's brand new and we've not seen it, so no one's immune to it. That's why everyone is potentially infectable. It's not necessarily more virulent than anything else. It's just different. And it is an antigenic shift because it's a major change. But that's not really important. The important thing is that we have to get immunized. Immunization will definitely help substantially. And unfortunately, the vaccine's not going to be available till October, I understand.
Now, is immunization mandatory in any health disciplines in the U.S.?
I was going to share that the Marshfield Clinic, a large regional center of physicians and all sorts of healthcare providers in central Wisconsin, just released a press release earlier this week that they're going to make vaccination mandatory for all of their employees, unless there's some extenuating circumstances. But that's like 7,000 or 8,000 people that they're planning to vaccinate, and it's the first time that they've made the influenza of they're mandating an influenza vaccine and still trying to determine if they'll do the same for H1N1 vaccine.
Wow.
We're in an interesting sort of conflict in Ontario because the flu shot is a requirement for all paramedics in Ontario, but it's not a requirement for nurses and physicians. So, you know, of course, the ones who don't believe in it or don't feel they should be getting it argue that other healthcare professionals don't seem to care or don't seem to be lumped into the same requirements.
Well, and you brought up an interesting point earlier, Rob. Is it workman's comp or worker's comp or not if you get sick on the job?
If it's compensatable?
Yeah.
Well, I guess if you can make a direct link between, you know, your...
Yeah, but how do you know? I think I just lost Rob again. But how do you know if you got the virus while on the job or not? I think that's going to be an interesting case to try and flush out as we go along. And you know, now quite honestly, I'm trying to determine if that's something we're going to require for our employees, because you know, why would I want to risk having people gone when I know full well they could have gotten a vaccine and maybe been at work or had some immunity against what was going on?
Well, in our public health department, it will be required that all of our first responders will be, that is, the people that interact directly with patients will be required to be vaccinated. And so when you talk about the entire hospital is vaccinated, we're looking and working with our hospitals. The entire hospital is not on a priority list to be vaccinated. It's the people who have first-hand contact with treating the illness, those who will be vaccinated.
Yeah, but isn't that a short-sighted view, though? If half the or more than half of the housekeeping staff get sick because they've been dealing in rooms where people had influenza, and now they can't take care of the laundry, and now you can't take more patients because more people are sick, wouldn't it be better to vaccinate those type of people as well?
Well, along with all of the Walmart checkout workers. I mean, it's the same exposure.
Well, yeah, but you know what? I don't need my Yoo-hoos or whatever I get at Walmart, but I sure want to make sure that I have a clean room at the next hospital that I'm going to stay at if I need to. I mean, I don't know.
They're not on the priority list.
I'm just playing devil's advocate.
But is it spread?
I know.
Spread predominantly through droplet, or is it contact with sort of cloth surfaces or other hard surfaces? I guess.
Well, I think Vincent said something about that earlier. What did you say about the?
It can be done both ways. It's aerosol and contact with hard surfaces. It will survive on a doorknob for a substantial amount of time, you know, a day. Children's toys, so you know you can eliminate one, but you'll still have the aerosol or vice versa.
But it's the same as you should have been dealing with seasonal influenza all along.
It's a good point.
Yeah, very good point.
I mean, it's really not different. It's just it's a new virus, and yes, we are not all vaccinated against it here at the beginning, but we should treat it the same.
Mm. And Anne, I hear you saying some things and that I think are important, is that we're really dealing with some preparedness issues here with something that might be relatively minor in its final scope, but is certainly telling us that we have questions that should have been answered before now, that we really aren't as prepared for these types of things as we should be. Do you agree?
No, I agree. And I agree, if anything, this is a true test of our preparedness, you know, systems, protocols, you know, interactions with the community members. Yes, the illness may not be so severe at this point, but it is really pushing us to be prepared in all aspects of closing schools, of, you know, limiting exposure, and how we deal with, do we wear masks or not during an EMS response for every, you know, respiratory illness or not. You know, if anything, it makes us think about when major deadly illness does hit us, how are we going to respond? And if anything, this is a true test to really make us kind of like dust off those manuals that we prepared a while ago and really figure out what should we do.
Well, I was going to ask Vincent too, what his perspective on this idea of how prepared should we be, or how nervous should we be about this?
Well, Ann's making some good points that you should always have good hygiene, and especially in healthcare workers, right? So you guys should carry a standard of care that perhaps is different from the general public. You all know that you can't get people to do the right thing year after year, you know, in terms of washing their hands and when they sneeze to cover their face and that sort of thing. You can barely get them to do it in a pandemic year. So I have little faith in the general population's ability to do that and remember how to do it. So I think that it's not a huge worry. It's a huge worry for people who are at risk and can die from it. And we know some of those people. But for everyone else, it's a lousy illness for 4 or 5 days. So, you know, I don't think you need to go to huge extremes to try and prevent infection, but common sense really helps.
Okay. And Anne, can you give us some pointers as far as what can EMS do to better interact with public health? Is there something we should be doing now that we could maybe, I don't know, maybe help give vaccinations, like you said earlier? Is there something else we should be doing or making those contacts with?
You know, I think get to know who your public health department is. And as a public health department right now in a rural community, I am approaching a seasonal and an H1N1 influenza season, and I cannot imagine being able to survive it without my EMS support system and without my paramedics. You know, I don't have enough nurses in order to vaccinate, and I really need this untapped healthcare resource and vital component of our healthcare system to interact and work with us in order to get this accomplished. And so I would say, contact them. Say, hey, we're here. We're available. We have untapped healthcare dollars and grant monies within public health that can help compensate and pay for paramedics to help us out. And, you know, work within your state public health department, and, you know, they're there. They're willing to help with this. And it's something we haven't really looked at before, but I could not imagine this upcoming season without paramedics helping us out.
All right, and how do you envision us working better, or how do we get our hands on all these N95 masks? Is there a way to do that, or I mean, all the suppliers are running short.
Well, and I'll tell you, as a public health department, we are getting them. They're being delivered to us daily. And that's another thing. Our hands are, you know, we have the contacts and the connections to have the supplies, to have the antivirals, to have the immunizations, to do what it takes. And, you know, to be the the body that's going to be saying, this group is our first priority group in our county, and this group is going to be the second level that will get the vaccinations, a better time than the EMS personnel to interact with public health and be able to say, hey, we're here to help. If you're there to help, you're going to be able to get your hands on all those supplies. You're going to be able to get your N95 fit testing done. You're going to be able to get your mask fit, the mask that you need. You're going to be the first in line then to get your vaccinations. Because if you're already interacting with them before these vaccinations come out and the masks are all there ready to go, that will put you to the front of the line.
Okay. Vincent, what about anything from your perspective that we ought to be doing virology-wise or other ways?
Get your vaccines. It's the best thing you can do. Get the seasonal one now, and then in a month get the 2009 one, and encourage everyone to do it. Now, there's a problem with immunization in this country, as you know, and the more you people in your field recommend it to people, the better, I think. I think just a little bit of advice really goes a long way.
Can I ask you about the safety of the... You know, I think that that's something that gets kind of overhyped on some conspiracy websites, that I read and listen to quite a bit. But, you know, the safety of vaccines and how... Are they safe? And are they going to give us some kind of weird disease, or is thimerosal or whatever else is in those vaccinations gonna really harm us in the future, or do we know? Or, you know, give us a quick intro to what it means to get vaccinated.
Vaccines are safe. Vaccines prevent millions and millions of infectious diseases every year. They save lives. There's no evidence that any of them do anything harmful. Many studies have been done, you know, to try and understand if a thimerosal has any effect on the safety of the vaccine. And they've all come out glowing, with the exception of a few that turn out to be defective. So immunization is a fundamental advance that we made many years ago that works, and it's the reason why we can live a long time nowadays compared to, you know, 100, 150 years ago. So you shouldn't be afraid of vaccines. They're really, really good.
And is there anything else that we, because I understand that there's going to be three vaccines this year. One's the seasonal and two H1N1. Why the two for H1N1 when I can just get one for seasonal?
So there are two different vaccines. One is available now. It has three different viruses in it. It has last season's H3N2, an H1N1, and an influenza B strain. So those were three strains that caused influenza last season, and which may come back. They haven't disappeared yet, so that's why you should get immunized with that vaccine. So that's called the trivalent that's available now. And then in about a month or so, we will have a second vaccine, which is against the new 2009 H1N1 strain. So that's just one virus in that vaccine. Those are being tested now, and then you should get that as well. And I should point out, these are all made the way flu vaccines have been made since the 1940s, you know, when Jonas Salk made the first ones. The same technology, it's been proven, used in millions and millions of people, completely safe. Except, of course, if you have egg allergies, then you shouldn't get the ones that are grown in eggs.
But are the ones this year grown in eggs, or do we know?
The bulk is going to be grown in eggs, because that's the technology that's been proven. There's a fraction of the vaccine that is grown in cells, that is not eggs, that is. So people with egg allergies, you get those. But those are the minimums, or less than 10% of all the vaccines that are made right now.
And is there going to be a mist option this year? You know, last year you had the ability to get the flu mist.
Yep, so flu mist is available. But then again, those are grown in eggs. So if you have an egg allergy, you shouldn't take flu mist.
Okay.
But flu mist is going to be the vaccine of the future, but grown not in eggs, my prediction is, because that mimics a natural infection. It gives you the best immunity. And if we can get away from the eggs, which I'm sure we will, then everyone can do that kind of immunization.
And
And actually, I mean, when we're giving anyone that's allergic to eggs and we're looking at the injectable influenza, any of the shots, it is at this point through American Academy of Pediatrics stating that we can give the injectable site to people that are allergic to AIDS. And so that is something that we do at this point, and we just sit and monitor them a little bit longer, but it outweighs the benefit, you know, the risk of that such a small reaction to the benefit of the vaccination.
Okay. I, you know, I've learned so much tonight. Thank you guys very much. We're running up right against the hour that we always try to keep everybody at, and we try to make sure that our audience doesn't want to run away after, you know, a 40 or an hour and 40 or 2 hours or whatever type of episode. But, Doctor, where can people find you? What are you talking about next? And, you know, I just looked at your website, TWIV.TV, and I just noticed that you have 49 episodes. This is 51 of ours, so we must have started right at the same time. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, about a year ago.
Yeah, my anniversary for this show is coming up in, I think, a week or a week and a half.
Yeah, so. We probably started at the same time. Well, so we have been talking a lot about influenza, as you might imagine, since April on the podcast. We do it every week. I collect stories and I try and the weekly virology stories, and I try to explain it to people. So we're just putting together Friday's episode. This past episode was really interesting. We talked about making influenza vaccines in plants, which seems like might work. And it's fascinating. I don't want to take time to go into it, but we try and explain virology in a way that people can understand. So if you want to learn about virulence and transmission, check it out.
I'm going to go over there, and I'm going to actually add it to my iTunes account. Can we find you on iTunes?
You can find it on iTunes, that's right, or that the website is twiv.tv. And I also have a blog, virology.ws, if you prefer to read. I have a couple of posts a week where I basically do the same thing. I try and teach people about viruses.
Virology.tv.
.ws.
Oh, .ws. I'm sorry. Okay, gotcha. And that was one last question I wanted to ask you about the vaccination. It's not a live, quote-unquote, live virus versus a dead virus, is it? I mean, what's the...
I'm glad you put people
should ask that and listen to your show. I don't know.
No, it's a good question. I'm glad you put live in quotes because viruses are not living.
Right. So they're neither dead nor living, correct?
It's somewhere in between, right. But they're certainly not alive. The egg-grown viruses, cell culture-grown viruses, are for the most part inactivated with formalin and then broken up with detergents. So those are not infectious. But the flu mist is an infectious vaccine. And that you inhale, and it grows in your upper respiratory tract, and so it mimics a natural infection.
So, will you feel sicker, like you get more aches, and just feel generally cruddy for the next day or two after you have it?
No, the flu mist is pretty good. It's what we call an attenuated vaccine. So, its virulence is severely reduced. So, there are very few side effects of that vaccine.
Okay, great. Well, everybody run over to and listen to Vincent's show, twiv.tv, and you can go to the website, emsgarage.com, and look for all of his great information. And you don't have a blog or Facebook. What do you have? Do you have anything? You want to plug?
Yeah, no. Just wash your hands. If you're sick, stay home and get your flu vaccine. That's my plug.
Very cool. I think that's a great plug that we should all learn. Maybe cdc.gov should be your plug. Everybody should go there to learn about the infectious diseases. I'm going to plug something for Greg Fries. He had to jump off, but he said, hey, let everybody know to go to rapidce.com and get a two-part free lesson on pandemic influenza. Who knows? I can't vouch for it, but if Greg put it together, I'm sure it's pretty good. So it's rapidce.com, and go there. It's free until the end of the year. Normally, that's a pay website, and they said you can download it for free just for listening to the EMS Garage because they love us over there at CenterLearn and all those other places. Mr. Jamie Davis, I'm sure you have something to plug this week.
Well, you know, I always have something to plug, but I think since Vince is here, and of course the EMS Garage is part of the ProMed Network, that you can find these shows, Vincent's This Week in Virology, a lot of other great programs with lots of good medical information for people of all kinds. My nursing show's there, the nursing show, also Medicast and everything else. You can find that at promednetwork.com, and, you know, 34 shows last time I counted. We're adding more all the time, but you know, different programs for different medical people of all strains. You can find it over there.
Hey, Jamie,
how you doing?
I never met you. Great.
Yeah, no, we've never talked on the phone, Vince. But I was so happy to hear you were going to be on the show tonight.
Well, thanks for suggesting. It's a great idea.
Oh, I guess I thought you guys knew each other I thought you guys have known each other for years, the way you guys talk.
Just as podcasters know each other, you know, by email and, you know, maybe a chat conversation here or there.
Gotcha. That's pretty funny. I'm gonna plug the Minnesota State Fair for Gary Wingrove. He jumped off, too. He said, I've got a bunch of people talking to me, and the screaming thing behind me is really bugging me, so he logged off. So, Minnesota State Fair, Google it if you want to go there next year. It sounds really fun. About 2 weeks of mayhem, it sounds like, and if you want to eat a really good funnel cake, funnel cake. Ugh, I'm sure that's a public health nightmare waiting to happen, all those diseases we're causing with cardiac events, but whatever. Rob Terrio from Ontario, do you have anything to plug tonight? Maybe he's not there. Rob Terrio, he's not there. Well, good enough. He's been having problems with his connection, poor guy. So I know that he has a blog. It's paramedictutor.wordpress.com. Go there and read about all of his ramblings. You can also find me on Twitter, Geeky Medic, pretty much on any social network. Go ahead and add me, and we'll try and go from there. I'll add you as a friend, and you can start following me right away. The other thing is, we're going to the EMS Expo. EMSExpoLive.com will be up here in a few weeks. We're going to be doing video podcasts. I know that Jamie Davis is going to be there doing a medic cast. I'll be there doing a couple of podcasts. I'll be doing EMS Garage. Greg Fries and Buck will be there doing an EMS Educast. We're going to try and bring Rob into that one as well. Hey, Rob, are you back?
I'm back.
I plugged your blog, but do you have anything else you want to plug?
No. Something's happening with Skype with me tonight. I don't know what's going on. But
I'll walk you through. We'll make it better for you at some point. Because there's a really cool way you can actually go into Skype settings and make it all kinds of fun things and open a port. We'll talk about that later. Anyway, so join us October 26th through the 30th in Atlanta, Georgia. If you can't make it, or you just don't have the funds to make it this year because of a recession or whatever else is going on, or you're dealing with H1N1, look for us live on the EMS Expo website. Just Google EMS Expo. Go to their webpage. We'll be on the homepage every day with live updates from the show floor. We've got so much video coverage of this show this year. It's going to be like you're there, but you know, you should go too, because I think it'll be a really good time. So EMS Expo, Google them and look for us. We're going to be there. You know, come out and cheer us on and talk to us on the show floor, because I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I think Jamie Davis has some pretty fun things planned too. Don't you, Jamie?
We are going to have a ball. We're going to be looking at different products and all kinds of fun stuff, and lots of video getting posted. I think everybody, they should pay a lot of attention. If you can't get down there live yourself, you can check out our live updates and other stuff we're going to upload throughout the course of that whole expo. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I know. I'm so excited for this year. It's like, it's all I can think about every day almost. It's pretty sad. But well, thank you guys very much. Thank you for joining us, Ann and Vincent. I really appreciate it. You guys bring a great perspective to us EMS hacks sitting here going, we should all be afraid of it. Run! Or something like that. So I thank you so much for joining us. Join us next week on the next EMS Garage when we talk more about EMS topics that relate to you.
Second time's the charm.
Man, I don't know where. Oh, man. I was.
Must have been the spit shield.